You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Yes, and for Dear Science this week, we are joined once again by Kushla McGovern. Good afternoon.
Kia ora.
And what a sciencey day we have for us with these three science stories. God, it feels great to be back in this seat. Corkscrew bacteria, what are these guys up to?
Yeah, so this is, last year we talked about a story about where it had been recently discovered a new way that bacteria move. And so when I saw this one, I was like, oh yeah, this is a good one. It's a bit of a follow-up in that we seem to have learned a lot about how bacteria move in the last couple of years, right? Because we've known for a long time that some bacteria, they have basically a tail. It's called a flagella, and it kind of rotates and moves, and bacteria can move through liquids and stuff. And the story we talked about last year was where they can set up a chemical gradient that they kind of swoosh across the surface. Well, today, these bacteria make themselves into basically like a screw or a corkscrew through a constrained channel. So what it turns out is you get some insects will have a symbiotic relationship with bacteria. So they want the bacteria in them because the bacteria do something for them,
right,
and the bacteria get food. So it's a good deal. So symbiotic, it's good for both.
Mm-hmm.
But to get these bacteria to get into the right places in these insects, which is a symbiotic organ, they've got to go through these really thin passages that are like 1 micron or less. So it's about the size of the bacteria.
Right.
And so with some modelling, if you do that and you look at, okay, do these bacteria just, you know, wag their tail, rotate their tail?
Yeah.
Did they go through? And it's kind of, no, they just kind of stir up the fluid, but they don't really move. So
right.
How are they getting through?
Right.
And so what these scientists did was they were able to use what's called fluorescence imaging. So they basically made the bacteria glow. And what they noticed is these bacteria can actually flick up their sort of flagella, their tails, and wrap it around them in basically like the thread on a screw.
Yeah.
And that, and then they can kind of propel themselves through these channels by basically kind of corkscrewing themselves down. And so there's some really awesome pictures in this paper of like imaging this, but it's kind of quite funky, and it's like these bacteria have basically evolved to use quite a mechanical process to navigate this quite complex environment of this minor sort of gap in that. And obviously then we always go, okay, how can we use this? So, you know, people are developing micro robots. So is this something that they can adapt to that, and having these micro drilling micro robots?
Because I'm guessing we can't get screws that small, right?
Not that I know of. Maybe some people have managed to do something in the micro fabrication space that are, you know, doing that. But yeah, it wouldn't be easy.
Yeah, very interesting. And then this next one, the cost of period pain. What's this about?
So this is a social science study.
Yeah.
So this is where you're basically using humans as your instrument for measurement. And so it's an Australian-based study where they were interested in the cost to productivity, or the loss in productivity caused by just period pain or heavy menstrual bleeding, which are the two most common things of problematic menstruation, right?
Yeah.
And so they basically did a survey of almost 1,800 women in Australia to see what were the kind of the relates that people had period pain, heavy period pain, heavy menstrual bleeding and such, because obviously females make up a reasonable part of the population. And it's kind of basically from averaging from about 12 years of age, women will have their first period, and then every 21 to 34 days and up until they're about 45 to 55 when it starts to slow down till it stops at menopause. So it happens quite a lot over for a lot of people for a bit of time.
Maybe it's a significant issue we should research.
So there has been a bit of research around this, not so much looking at the cost of productivity. So some previous research had said that about 90% of women experience some form of period pain, and this survey found that it was 97% had experienced period pain in the last 3 months. 75% said it was always.
Wow.
So that's high already. Yeah. In terms of heavy menstrual bleeding, it was about 20 to 25%. And so, you know, like this, you know, like these period pain in that, there's stuff like headaches, that's cramps, that's, you know, heavy menstrual bleeding. You start to get iron loss, so you get fatigue. So these do actually have a physiological effect, but it obviously also then, because it is still a taboo subject to people, people try and hide that it's affecting them or and stuff, and so they're trying to work at the same rate. So you get these things called absenteeism or presenteeism. So either someone just doesn't go to work. They take the day as leave or unpaid leave. That's absenteeism. Or they turn up to work, but they're not at 100%. They're not, you know, doing as much as they normally would. So that's presenteeism.
Yeah.
And so these obviously cost in terms of productivity because you're not working to the level that you could. And so by using these numbers of the percentage of these women that were suffering from period pain and heavy menstruation, they could do some calculations. And there are various models, but the model that's kind of in the mid-range kind of put the cost to productivity at $14 billion to the Australian economy.
Yeah.
It's a massive amount.
It's a massive amount, right? Like, I saw this headline and I was like, is it a B or an M?
Yeah,
like $14 billion.
That's so much money.
It is. And this study only looked at women that were had been employed or were volunteering for the previous 3 months to when the survey was conducted. It didn't look at the unpaid work people do, so you know, like childcare, caring things. So there's all that as
where
well.
Where women are overrepresented as well.
Exactly.
Wow.
And it didn't look at the costs of medical care or treatment because, of course, you know, at the very least, a lot of women are taking ibuprofen or Panadol or something. But then there's, you know, a whole lot of other, like, depending on how bad it is, you know, people might have to go to the doctor and stuff. So there's all those costs as well. So it's likely an underestimate, which is kind of scary. But they were also just using this to make the point that we treat it as a very private issue, but it's probably not – it's not clever, right?
Yeah.
Because it's happening to, you know, so much of your population. So at least workplaces should be starting to think about it, whether that's reproductive leave or that's flexible working, you know, like – hybrid working, which we've obviously all become a lot more familiar with, but also flexible working hours, so like the rest periods, so that, you know, people still do their work, but maybe it's done more to their physiology.
Yeah.
But then also going, well, maybe governments should actually be looking at this given
all
workplaces are going to face
solutions. No.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there have been some studies around that have started to look at what is the cost to an economy of putting in reproductive leave versus the cost if you don't. And I think it's in Australia as well. Like, it was basically, yes, it costs a lot of money to offer reproductive leave, which is kind of the term that they've named, they've given it, but it costs a lot more not to. And
so
I think in the, hopefully in the next few years we start to see a bit more discussion at least in this space.
I mean, $14 billion seems like a pretty cut and dry number.
It's big, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, like, so you think, there'd be some benefit to considering this.
I mean, is it also because some workplaces are generally very male-dominated, so
you can imagine that across, it would be really interesting. Like, they didn't consider, it was actually one of the things this paper had put into their limitations and future outlooks, was looking at the type of work, right?
Yeah.
Because they didn't do that, they just was work. And so I imagine that, probably varies very much across the different fields and the gender domination within them.
It's majority men. And you're like a few women, it's kind of hard to talk about what's happening.
Yeah.
And then this last one, Pompeii public bath hygiene. What's going on in those baths? Is it like, I saw this headline and I thought, like, poor hygiene, but what does that mean for them, right? Is everyone dirty back then?
So it's a little bit of, people were probably a little bit dirty, and it was also that the bath wasn't really getting cleaned out.
Right.
Which is actually, in a way, good for the study, because if they had been regularly, like, really scouring their bath, they wouldn't have anything to study.
Interesting.
So Pompeii, an absolutely amazing site, archaeologist's dreamland, right? Because it's so well preserved, and it gives us such a snapshot in time of Roman culture at that time. So Pompeii was basically Mount Vesuvius erupted in 79 Common Era. It covered the place in ash, and so that's why it's a snapshot, because everything got really well preserved. And so each year you kind of hear about new things that are being discovered, and like mosaics where the colour is still really vibrant and this sort of thing. But it was a Roman city of the time, and so it had public bathhouses because public or bathing was important as part of a cultural thing.
Yeah.
So it had three major public bathing houses: Republican, Stabian, and Forum.
Mm.
Now, Bath needs water. Pompeii didn't have a close-by, easily accessible natural water source.
Right.
So
employing those classic Roman aqueducts?
Well, not at the start. Right. So first off, they had to use wells or they had to collect the rainwater. So these wells, they would dig down to the deepest were about 40 metres. But the groundwater was at like 27 to 30 metres. So you had to use a lot of people power to fill the bath. And then you'd heat the bath in these bronze sort of vessels and stuff, and you'd fill the bath and people would bathe through the day. And then it wasn't till about 33 before Common Era, so kind of the turn of the millennium there, that the aqueduct came in. So then it was this Aqua Augusta, or the Sereno Aqueduct, then started supplying Pompeii. And then it was using a natural spring. And so the water changed quite a lot, because when it was coming out of the groundwater, the well, it had a lot of minerals and stuff in it, and you couldn't really drink it. But when it came from the natural spring, now you could drink it, and it was a very different profile to the chemicals that were in it.
Yeah.
But it was always what we call hard water. So you know, like when you see a jug and it's got the white stuff that's caked on the inside?
Yeah.
We call that hard water. It's basically, it's got calcium carbonate in it. Water evaporates, it precipitates out. And this is what happened in these baths and these wells and these aqueducts. You've got these big or these thick deposits of this calcium carbonate. So in some areas, it's up to 3 centimetres thick.
Wow.
So they've sampled that.
Yeah.
And studied that. And so this has given them a chemical record of what was going on. And so by looking at this, what they could start to tell is, because they could sample the water from the natural spring and the wells as it is now, they could know something about the chemistry of that water. So they could look at the calcium carbonate across these different baths and regions, and they could start to go, okay, the water came from there and the water came from there at this time. So they know when the aqueduct came in. They know when the aqueduct came in, the Republican bathhouse got shut down, so it was only ever well water.
Right.
And so by looking at that well water in that Republican bathhouse, they could see that. But what they could also do is look at the carbon and oxygen isotopes, and they could see in the well what the profile looked like, and then they could compare it to the where the actual bathing, the pool was, and the drainage. And they could see that the carbon-13 decreased. Now, carbon-13 is a reflection of the water itself and the geology, but it's also a reflection of microbial activity. And because we've got what's happening in the pools, well, people are getting in, they're bathing,
right,
and then in the drains, that's where the water's going out. So they've interpreted this change in the carbon-13 as actually, it's probably that you had some microbes growing, and then you actually had human waste, like the urine and the sweat and stuff off people. And so it's kind of implying that the water wasn't changed regularly, like maybe each day sort of thing. So go for a bath in the morning, not in the evening, because in the evening,
it's probably quite rank.
Yeah.
And then imagine if you're everyone pulling it up out of a well, you don't really want to change it more than once a day.
Exactly right. Yeah. So once you went to the aqueduct system, where it was a lot easier, it kind of became a bit cleaner. And so because they were able to, in the Stabian baths, it had an older region and a newer region, and so they could compare them. And that's it.
Right. That's very interesting. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for coming in, Kushla. Thank you for sharing these science stories with us. Thank you, as always, to Moshat, and thank you, science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Moshat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.